Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, cloudy as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 113, Shine Through. Sunday, March 13th, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Today's episode features the following segments: Chin Wagon, Ever-Expanding Skill Set, Yarn Lover at Large, On the Porch, and Off the Shelf. I'd like to extend a very special welcome to two folks who have introduced themselves on the Ravelry thread recently. Rainbow Ange is Angela from Swindon in the UK, and Storm Coast is Jen from New Hampshire, and she is the host of the Uncreative Crafter videocast. Thank you both for your kind words and encouragement. And thanks to everyone who has been contributing to the threads in the Yarns at Yin Hu group on Ravelry lately. I feel like discussion is becoming more lively and folks more interactive as the podcast listenership grows. And I'm really grateful for that and try to participate in the conversation as much as I can. It's been a very busy week, just over a week since I recorded the last podcast. Yesterday, I attended session 3 of the Sheep to Shawl course at the Fibercraft Studio. I'm in a second cycle of the course and working on deepening my experience. But the other thing that is happening is that Chris and Sono, the teachers of the class, are offering up a little bit of a different experience than we had last year. So some of the activities are certainly different than what we did last time. And one of those things is that we are working on watercolors as a means of color exploration. We've been traveling to the art room twice now on the campus of the Waldorf School and meeting with this amazing art teacher, Brigitta. Her room is full of the fabulous projects of her high school students. And when we arrived yesterday, she had tacked up all of the watercolor paintings in warm colors that we had completed last time. So we walked into a room that was just filled with orange and reds and yellows, very warm and vibrant colors. And then we took our seats, and it was as though the warmth of the sun coming in the windows behind us was amplified by the warmth from our paintings. But we couldn't see them. Our attention was focused on Brigitta, and we were talking about blue and blue tones and using blue color in watercolors. Blue is a little bit slower to work with, and you can work with the paint on the paper a little bit longer than the reds and yellows. So we just worked on one painting yesterday, and we were instructed first to lay on as much blue as we could onto the paper, to really layer it. And we had an ultramarine blue and also a blue that had a little more of a warmth, a red to it. I'm forgetting the name right now. So we did that, and we just put this blue on our paper. I concentrated on applying the paint in long strokes. And I would just take my arm and without moving my wrist, really, I would just move my whole arm with the wide brush and I applied the paint. Then we rinsed our brushes and Brigida told us to use a clean, nearly dry brush to remove some of the paint. So I looked at my page and there were places where the paint was naturally a little bit thinner. I could see spots and lines and a few curves in that space. And so I worked on removing those areas more thoroughly because we weren't creating a literal painting of something. So we weren't really creating shapes or a picture. And so I thought just working with what I already saw on the page would be a way of going for something abstract and not literal. So I kept cleaning my brush and wiping it off and then removing a little bit of that blue paint, cleaning the brush again. And then we used one space or area where we could apply some red and create a sort of purple or maroon portion of our painting, just in one area. And then the final thing was that we could take yellow, canary yellow, and we could apply it in the spaces where we had removed paint, as though light from behind the blue was shining through it. And Brigida had gone through some art history and shown us some different eras of painting and representation where gold was very important to portraying the sky. Nowadays, typically, when you see a sky, when children draw a sky, the sky is blue. But if you look at the history of painting, that hasn't always been the case. And so our use of gold was a sort of a reach back into a previous era of painting. When I used the canary yellow, there were some places where I had removed the paint almost completely. The blue was almost gone. And in those places, the yellow really popped through like a bright light. In other places, my removal of the blue was less complete. Or maybe also there was a little bit of water still on the paper. And so when I painted with the yellow, it created a little bit of a greenish color. And the combination of those things was very interesting. All this time I was working vertically, and when I was nearly done, well, I didn't know I was nearly done, but Brigida came around and she was looking at everyone's paintings. And one of the things she was doing was talking with them about orientation. Just because I had created the painting vertically didn't mean that that was naturally the best way to display it or the best way to view it. So she just spun the board on which I was working so that there was a horizontal orientation, and it looked like a horizon and water and stars appearing over the water and sparkling through. And that's the point at which I decided I was nearly done with my painting because I couldn't see any way to make it better or more appealing to me. And I just added a little bit more yellow in a few places to really get that bright yellow shining through. And then I was done. So I've included an image of this watercolor that I completed yesterday for the cover art of this episode. And This week, there have been lots of other instances of shining through as well, so I thought it was a good theme for the episode. One of the many gratifying aspects of the Sheep to Shawl course is the opportunity to work with such amazing students in the class, as well as the instructors that we have. I met Judith Simmons last year. She was in her second cycle of the course, and she is currently taking a third. And so we've come to know each other. I've visited her school before. She works at Phillips Academy Charter School in Newark, New Jersey, and is the handwork teacher there. So last year I toured the school, and ever since I've had it in my mind that I've really wanted to bring some of my high school students to the school. And this past Thursday, we were able to accomplish that goal. I brought 15 students from the schools where I work. They're from grades 9 through 12. And Judith identified some of her fifth graders. And we brought them together for a few hours after my students had toured the school and eaten an amazing lunch. The fifth graders taught the high school students how to use Kumihimo looms, which are small cardboard looms. And we brought a blending board and lots of fiber dyed with vibrant colors. And we mixed those colors with natural dyed fiber to create roll legs for the students because they are learning how to spin. And it was just a beautiful, magical day about which I would like to say much more. However, I really want my students to do the talking about their visit. And so I will work to schedule a recording session with them at some future date and share that with listeners on the podcast because I've received many requests to hear from the string theorists. And I think they had such a wonderful time that they really would like to share some of their experience. We can look forward to that at some future date. In the meantime, I encourage you to watch a video that was filmed by Craft Yarn Council at Judith's school, Phillips Academy Charter School. I've mentioned this video before, and I did provide a link in the show notes again for this episode. It really provides an overview of the goals of the handwork program, and more importantly, the students' appreciation for and understanding of what it's all about. So if you have just a few spare minutes, this video is guaranteed to brighten your day and to get you thinking. Ever-expanding skill set. In March, lemon is the featured ingredient for hashtag Power Pantry, and many listeners have been cooking along with lemons and sharing their ideas on the thread. This week, I made a lemon ricotta cake because I had made some stuffed shells and had leftover ricotta. And I just love a lemon ricotta cake around springtime. It's just great density and richness and then brightness of flavor. Also, I made a lemon pasta. One of my favorite pasta topping combinations is leftover ham that's been diced, frozen peas, and a sauteed onion. I just think that combination is sort of salty and sweet, and it's just great. But I wanted to add lemon to the dish, so while I had my pasta cooking, I grated the entire rind of a lemon and squeezed all of the juice and set that aside. When the pasta was done, I drained it, put it back into the pot with about, a tablespoon or so of olive oil, And then I tossed the pasta with about a third of a cup of Greek yogurt, all of the lemon juice, and most of the lemon rind. I twirled the pasta onto the plate. I was using a very thick spaghetti, but you could really use any kind of pasta. So I just put a twirl of pasta on the plate and then topped it with the peas and ham mixture and then sprinkled over some of the lemon rind that I had reserved and quite a bit of freshly ground pepper. It was just really delicious. It was rich and creamy. At the same time, it was very light and tart. So I've included that recipe on the blog for this episode, and I will link it in the Ravelry thread as well. This coming week, I have plans to make Moroccan chicken with some preserved lemons and at least one other thing involving lemon. I'm not sure. I haven't decided on a recipe yet. I also wanted to share a question that was raised by Jacqueline Salem on the thread this past week. She asked about limes versus lemons. Are there situations where one is preferable to another? Are they interchangeable? What are your thoughts? And I did give this a good deal of thought. The most specific thing, I suppose, I can say about it is that I find limes to have more of a cooling property than lemons. Lemons for me can almost be warm in flavor, not cool. And so I tend to use limes where there is spice or heat in a dish. So Mexican-inspired things, Thai-inspired things. I tend to use lemon where I just want a tartness, a brightness, where my aim is really not to have a lemon flavor necessarily, but to heighten the other flavors in the dish. I also use lemon in curries and other Indian-inspired cooking because the Indian food, the curries I tend to cook have more warming spices to them. I know there can be very hot curries, but that's not really what I gravitate toward in my cooking. So I tend not to use lime in a curry, but I will use lemon. And then also in terms of, you know, French-inspired, Italian-inspired, I would not go to a lime for those types of dishes. I would go for a lemon. That's my point of view on lemons and limes, but what about you? What advice do you have for Jacqueline? What rules of thumb? What are the particular culinary tastes in your household? I'm sure she would love to hear from you on the Ravelry thread. Yarn lover at large. This past weekend, Samuel and I traveled to Saratoga Springs, New York, because his band Bovine Social Club was playing at Cafe Lena, and we planned a little bit of a weekend getaway. The temperatures were cold, but the weather was clear and sunny, and overall it was just a really nice and relaxing weekend away. It didn't hurt that we were given a very luxurious upgrade at the hotel where we were staying. And I was able to do a bit of shopping and visiting in addition to hanging out with the band. On Saturday morning, I took a quick drive outside of Saratoga Springs to visit Carol of Foster Sheep Farm. She has a lovely farm with Romney and Wensleydale sheep, as well as a fully stocked yarn store on the premises. I arrived early before the formal opening of the yarn shop and was treated to lovely conversation with Carol and members of her family as well as a visit to the barns to see some of the baby lambs, and also there was a lamb birthing while I was there. So that you had a very trying morning, but it was really great to have the experience and spend time with Carol and her family. And we'll get to see Carol again during the Farm and Fiber Tour when I'm back up in the area in April. If you are interested in a great April day touring farms and doing a little bit of shopping, I recommend that you check out the Farm and Fiber Tour in Washington County, New York. It's the last full weekend in April. And also on the tour, I've provided a link to the Battenkill Fiber Mill in Greenwich, New York. That will be open during the tour, but is also worth a visit. And there is shopping there as well. So I've provided links for you to check those things out. In Saratoga Springs is one yarn shop, a cute yarn shop, just on the main drag of Broadway. It's called Common Thread. And I also made a visit there, needed to pick up some notions for my swap partner, Lorna, and also talked to the proprietor about the upcoming Southern Adirondack Fiber Festival in Washington County. The Southern Adirondack Fiber Festival is at the end of September each year. It hosts many of the same vendors who go to Rhinebeck, but without a lot of the crowds and craziness. So if you have an interest in a festival that has a little bit more of a laid-back feel to it, I recommend that you take a look at the dates and see if this would be a good time for a visit. On the porch. I haven't begun any new projects since the last podcast recording. I've just been working away on the cabled border to the Hedy shawl by Isolde Teague. I have added some repeats to the border so that the shawl is even larger. It looked to me to be about a medium-sized shawl, but I have a very large wingspan, and I have plenty of yarn for this shawl. So I thought it would be a good idea to just add a few repeats and make it bigger overall. My understanding is that once I complete the border, the cabled border of this shawl, it will go very quickly with the garter stitch interior of the shawl or center. So I've just been working methodically. I definitely find that the cable directions for the second half of the border are not as intuitive as the first half. I memorized the first part about, I don't know, 10 repeats in. I had it memorized, and then I could just, you know, keep going on the border. The second part, the way the directions are written, it just kind of defies memorization for me, and I do need to glance at the pattern at the beginning of each row just to make sure that I'm proceeding correctly. The Romney yarn has a beautiful high twist to it, so even though it's a dark, muted color, the cabling is showing up very nicely on the border. And it's really a pleasure to work with. I will be working on this Hedy shawl in March and probably a bit of April as well. And then I plan to start the Paper Cranes shawl in May and complete it by the end of June. I'm still working on yarn selection for the Paper Cranes. But I have had many folks express some interest in a sort of a knit along. So I'm going to open it up from now until the end of June. You can work on and hopefully complete either of these patterns, just working at your own pace. And I have converted the prize thread for the pattern prize into a knit-along thread. So I've kept everyone's wonderful stories about gifts and knitted gifts. And we can continue adding to that with progress photos, finished object photos. And I will have some prizes available and do a drawing when the knit-along concludes in June. One prize that I have is a beautiful shawl pin that I purchased at Common Thread in Saratoga Springs. And so I will be including a photograph of that shawl pin and posting it on the thread sometime this week. And I'm sure I will collect other prizes in my travels. So by July, there should be a nice little prize pool, and then I'll draw from there. So definitely chatter, encourage one another, post progress photos of your shawls. And let me know what you think of these two patterns. The Hedy I had in mind as a nice, you know, end of winter shawl. And part of the reason I'm working a little bit slowly on it is that the weather has changed to something distinctly spring-like. And the heavy cables of the shawl, it doesn't really seem like I will have much opportunity to wear the shawl after completing it. It will just go in a box for the autumn, which is fine. It's a beautiful shawl, and I will be happy to take it out again in the fall. But it did dampen my motivation a little bit. One topic that's come up as I've been hosting the hashtag Power Pantry Cookalong is the abundance of food writing that is available and the true enjoyment that many listeners have found in some of the titles in this genre. For me, food writing and I guess culinary memoir is one of the most important genres in my reading history. I find it very powerful. I think that because cooking food and eating is activity that involves all of the senses, it's particularly powerful writing, and there are lots of opportunities to connect with the author. And I thought it would be a good idea to compile a list of some best-loved titles in this genre and host a read-along during the summer months. Rather than all of us reading one text, I thought maybe we could focus on a genre and everyone could choose a work in the genre and read along, but feel like you're part of something bigger, and maybe share some passages and some insights that strike you. By food writing, I don't mean cookbooks, although there are often recipes included in books like these. When I started thinking about food writing, I came up with three distinct subtopics. And there may be more, but the three I thought of were culinary memoir or biography, where the author examines a life, but through the lens of food or food culture. One of my favorite examples of this is Climbing the Mango Trees by Mata Joffrey. She writes about her young life growing up in India, but concentrates on the influence that food had on herself and her family, and even the larger community. So you learn other things about Mater Joffrey, but mainly you learn how food was an influence in her life. Another category, or subcategory, I guess I should say, is food journalism. Often these are books written by seasoned journalists who take a less personalized but no less interesting approach on a single topic. One example is Mark Kurlansky, who has written Salt and Cod, where he's examining the history of an ingredient, and it becomes a lens through which you can understand or review a lot of history that you've probably learned and forgotten. But it becomes more fascinating when you look at it through the history of salt and its importance to people, for example. Another category, I don't have any works in this category, but I think it exists, which is food fiction. Fiction where the setting is maybe a kitchen or a restaurant, or the characters have jobs connected to the food industry in some way. I don't know any titles, but I feel like this might be a subcategory that exists. What I've done is I've opened a page on the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry, and I believe I've set it up so that any member of the group can edit the page and add titles and authors. These could be things you've enjoyed a lot. They could be things on your to-read list. There are lots of possibilities. And together, I'd like for us to create a comprehensive list so that when summer comes, we can each select a title that seems appealing and read along and have a kind of a conversation about food writing. I was inspired by Jenny, who is Salmon Knits on Ravelry, to order a copy of Coming Home to Eat, The Pleasures and Politics of Local Food by Gary Paul Nebon. So unless I complete that before June, I think that will be my summer read. I do have some other titles to finish before I get going on that one. What about you? What book titles do you have to share, and what's been on your reading list in this genre? I hope that you'll take the opportunity to contribute to our collaborative list and think about selecting a title for yourself.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flowery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes, or liking the show's Facebook page, or joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry. The music for the episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week. Nature.
riches ever get you high, till your face is mine. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature.